Egg session number 27748, reel 3.
Richard Songo, reel 3. Do you want to have a break now, Dick?
Yeah, let's have a break, shall we?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But going back to your time on the Eagle, before you left the Eagle, what was broadly different between a carrier and an ordinary ship of the fleet?
I think the difference mainly was it so much more serious on a carrier, because you've got those flying operations and the ship had to be operated very efficiently during flying operations. So all the what they called special sea duty men would be closed up. So the coxswain would actually steering the ship would be the coxswain. You know, normally he's like a chief petty officer, he's the best steerer in the ship, and he has a whole team of sailors who steer the ship the rest of the time. They're all, whereas when special sea duty men, he's the man. When down in the engine room, you will have one of the senior engineers in overall charge of the engine room, and you'd have a lot of engineering officers actually down there, more than would be for normal watch keeping. Same in the boiler rooms. You'd have probably the boiler room officer down there, whereas he wouldn't normally be down there, plus the best petty officers and chief petty officers actually manning the boilers themselves, with ratings as well. But I mean, in other words, you've got the best people at any job when you special sea duty when they're closed up. On the bridge, the captain would be there all the time, the navigator would be there all the time, whereas normally when the ship's steaming, it's the officer of the watch. So right through the ship, it's at sort of maximum readiness. And that means that if you're, say, flying every day, the mess is sort of running continuous meals rather than dinner at a certain time, because, you know, air crew are coming off their sorties, they still need breakfast, though it's lunchtime, and so on. And so the ship is running a sort of continuous battle station in a way. And the wardroom in the evening, normally at 6 o'clock the bar open and most officers are there having a drink. Well, at sea, that wouldn't happen because all the officers are probably going to be on call maybe for night flying or early in the next morning. And so there was a sort of unwritten rule that you didn't drink when flying operations were on. And that's not to say that there was a lot of alcoholism in the Navy, because it's about the only leisure activity at sea. So, I mean, no doubt those had bottles in their cabin, but, I mean, the majority of us didn't drink when you were working at sea. So that made a difference. It wasn't so convivial. It was more serious, you know. All the officers didn't congregate at one time and you'd go round the wardroom picking out your friends and saying hello and all the rest of it, because they would, some of them, be on watch and others would be doing this, that and the other, or getting ready to fly, that sort of thing. Yeah.
And you said also that the pilots tended to be characters, and alongside of them were these careers men. How did that all work out?
Yes, the ordinary officers, you know, the career officers, resented the, as they were called, flyboys, only a little bit. But, I mean, there was a sort of resentment there, because you got, well, in my day, I don't know what it was then, but you got £1 a day extra flying pay. And that, also in my day, that just about doubled your salary. I mean, it doesn't sound ludicrous now, doesn't it? You know, £7 a week. But it made a huge difference. And it if you, you know, for a given rank, it meant that you were more carefree. You got more money in your pocket. And also, I mean, if you're going to be a pilot, you've definitely got to live for the day. You've got to enjoy your day. Not that you're always thinking it's going to be your last, but you've got to have a... you know, don't have a long-term view. You're trying to make as good a job of it as you can on that day. And so you're going to enjoy your day, even though you might mess things up. It's still going to be a joke afterwards, rather than, oh, my career's doomed, which, you know, a ship handler, if he hits the dockyard wall, probably his career is doomed. So you can see that that would have an effect. So there were two groups of people. There were the flyboys, and there was the ship's company. And as far as the ship's company concerned, it was jolly nice when the squadrons flew off, because it meant more space. You know, you doubled the ship's complement as soon as the squadrons came on. And there was all this noise going on all day, and, you know, flying operations, where ship people wanted to run a ship. They didn't actually want to run an airfield, which is what they were actually having to do.
Did you ever talk to any of the pilots who crashed their plane or had a tricky landing afterwards and say what happened? Or
no, we were a bit... I don't think we think that would be a bit too forward, you know. I mean, they were always surrounded by their own chums. You know, there was that sort of support. You know, if something happened, then, you know, the chums on the squadron would be doing the boosting and getting you cheerful about the situation and laughing about it and turning it into a joke. And then you had to... Those pilots who crashed their planes then had to fill in the log to say why they'd... there was a special form to say why you'd crashed a plane. Very difficult filling in those forms, yeah. Yes, it was called an A-49. There was this song, you know, you scramble out of the wreck, but I still have to render my A-49, you know, which is filling in this form. So that was their attitude, you know. You filled in the form, and if the aircraft was badly damaged, the engineer officer of that squadron would inspect it and make a decision, and it would be pushed straight over the side. And we saw that happen a few times, which is amazing in these days of conservation. You think you just push a plane over the side. Well, that's what they did.
I mean, so the seabed around where you went.
Well, yeah, so there'd be airplanes, yeah, yeah.
And why weren't they taken home and repaired?
Well, because it was called uneconomic to repair. So if the fuselage had an enormous kink in it, and if it had, you know, the wing was, you know, it was just a question of, you know, you had to make a decision. There's no point in taking it home because you're going to scrap it anyway, and it was in the way. The other thing about a damaged aeroplane, the wings probably wouldn't fold, and you'd have to do something drastic to get the wing to fold if it was already bent, and then it's going to take up a lot of space in the hangar, and there's never enough space in hangars. The aircraft, half of them, are ranged on deck all the time, even though, you know, the sea spray going over them and all the rest of it. So if you've got an aeroplane that's no good, best thing is to push it over the side.
And I imagine there must have been a considerable surplus of aircraft left over from the war. Then would you still be flying some of those?
Well, they would have been, yes, because production didn't cease until sort of a couple of weeks after the end of the war. And there were, you know, still aircraft coming through, and so they would then be modified to the latest mark, you know, because aeroplanes go through a development stage their whole life until they're scrapped. So some of those planes probably might have been wartime ordered ones, anyway. Mm.
So it wouldn't have been that much to push them over the side. It wasn't like...
No, you're not... You know, I don't think the country was losing much money, no.
What about the actual business of the ship, the carrier, as planes came into land? What was the drill with that? I mean, in terms of steaming into the wind, smoke?
Yes, that's right. So... again, because you had all the top people down in the engine room, they were very conscious of the fact that they shouldn't make any smoke, even though, of course, they were at very high powers, because the ship steamed into wind, and if there wasn't a lot of wind, there is a wind speed for any particular aircraft that must be over the deck in order to make a safe landing, because otherwise, if you were... your speed relative to the deck is too high, you could pull the hook out or damage the undercarriage. So you can see there the commander flying, who's in charge of the flying operations, who's got a little bridge that sticks out from the side of the captain's bridge, where he overseas flight operations. I mean, he's got a wind indicator up there, and he would have to make sure that that flying speed was, or the deck's wind speed was there. So the ship, if it's if there wasn't much natural wind, would have to work herself up to her absolute maximum speed, which is putting a big strain on everybody, and certainly on the ship. And that's the time when you can imagine it very easy to make a little smoke, you know, because all the sprayers down in the boilers are flat out. You know, one gets dirty, the chap has to switch it off, put another one on, that might smoke. You know, there's a lot of individual effort goes into working a ship up to high power. So there's that going on, trying to keep the deck clear of smoke. And it is very disconcerting when you come round onto finals to line up with the deck, if there is any haze, because it may not be smoke, but it's like it's the funnel gases. And they're like a mirage. You get the mirage effect, so that looking through it onto the deck is wavering around. So you don't want that. You want, if anything, the ship to steam such that the wind is blowing slightly away from the deck, so that there's no chance of smoke interfering with the pilots coming down, because there's a left-hand circuit onto the deck, so you can see if the fumes are blowing away onto the starboard side, that's a good way to have it. Yeah.
And the coxswain steering the ship would know all of this because he was...
The captain would have given him a course, and then the commander flying would tell the captain, you know, another 5 degrees to port or starboard or whatever. You know, it was obviously, it's a team operation running an aircraft carrier. So they'd be all interacting with each other, and the old coxswain down below would be keeping the ship as steady as he can. And also at full power, he's got a hell of a job, because the thing wants to yaw all over the place, and he's, you know, knowing his experience of the ship, knowing that, you know, always need to keep 5 port on or something, and so he's got to keep that on all the time as he's also adjusting the course. There's a lot of skills going into it.
He's down below. He's not.
I'm afraid he's right at the bottom of the ship. Yeah. In those days, because of you know, the damage control thing, the steering position is right in the bottom of the ship, so that it sort of gets damaged last. That's the idea. So they go down a really long tunnel hatchway to get to their station right at the bottom. There are other places the ship can be steered from, but they're only in use when the other one's been knocked out. You can actually steer it by being with the rudder, you know, right on top of the rudders, and steer it there with a little valve. But I mean, that's the last resort.
And where was your battle station?
Oh, well, my battle station would be whoever I was the doggy of, you know, whoever I was following around. So if I was lucky, it would be with the commander or the navigator or somebody on the bridge, but it could just as well be somebody in the engine room or somebody on a gun platform or something like that. Yeah, so you moved around. The whole point of the training was, you know, you spend perhaps a week as the captain's doggy, then the commander's doggy, then the engineer officers, and so on. And then the electrical, yeah, so there was all the other branches that you followed around.
And how long would you be closed up for?
Oh, well, flying stations, you know, you probably take an hour shooting the aircraft off, and the fighters would only have an hour's endurance. So the ship would then slow down back to a sort of ordinary cruising speed while they were off doing their sortie. And then when they were starting to come back, the ship would then work up to its full power again. So there was a sort of a respite time between flights when the ship could go back to normal routine. And then it would gird itself up again, and everybody would be on top line for the landing on. The taking off is not so critical, you know, because after all you're going off the front of the ship, you haven't got the problems. But again, you need full power because you need as much speed as possible to launch the aircraft off. Not much wind speed over the deck.
So if we move on now, we jump ahead, then you went on to the Ulysses, the hell ship.
The hell ship Ulysses.
And which you finally decommissioned and
destored. That's right. Yeah.
And what happened next? You're now a sub lieutenant, or you're
no, as a midshipman. But then we were at the end of that time, we were commissioned. And because we were engineer officers, we then joined the RN Engineering College, was then at Keyham.
In Plymouth.
Yeah, in Plymouth, and it was sort of at the back of the dockyard. And then it was a lovely building with a huge oak-lined mess with pictures of Jutland, huge paintings of Jutland. It was called HMS Thunderer, that was the name of the shore station of Keyham, and so there were pictures of Thunder at Jutland, you know, firing enormous broadsides at the enemy fleet. And we had individual cabins there, and we had it was right opposite the gasworks, Keyham Gasworks, and we had, you know, typical naval fashion, when you were when it was your turn for duty, you had various duties, one of which was to be part of the fire, the fire service for the college, and we had one of those ladders with wheels, you know, those big wooden cartwheels, and you know, you manually moved it around, and then you hauled on ropes, and the ladder went up, and to our joy, one day there was a fire in the gasworks. So we all rushed over the road without, I mean, they didn't need a ladder in there, but I mean, it was jolly good fun. Yeah, it was a tremendous fire. It was a sort of coke heap caught fire or something. And then, of course, the real fire brigade came, and it was a wonderful night. One of the big nights at Keyham. Yeah.
And what were you being trained in then now?
It was the start of your degree in engineering, and so this was the first part. So I think you spent a year at Keyham, then you went to sea for, I think, a year. That would have been looking at various departments. And then when you came back, you then specialised in either electrical engineering or aircraft engineering. So this was the beginning of our degree course, you know, it was the usual stuff, you know, maths, physics, chemistry, all the rest of it. And it was an exciting place. It was very Victorian in the bathroom. I love the bathrooms. They were huge tiled, white tiled echoing places, with about five enormous baths on claw feet, spaced down the centre. So you and your chums would grab a bathroom, and then you'd sit in these baths like lords, putting the world to rights. It was just wonderful. And they didn't have plugs. They had sluices. At the end, there was a big knob you lifted up, and a grill at the end, and a sluice came up, and the water thundered out of these things. It was just terrific.
I wonder if they're still there now.
No, they've destroyed it. They knocked it down. They knocked this wonderful building down, all made of Plymouth limestone. There was a huge billiard room, snooker room, with about four full-size tables. I mean, it was a sort of gentleman's club again, you know. It was a good time. We didn't do much of the instruction there. That's where we lived. Every day we got into buses and went up to Manadon, which is where the main engineering college was and had big instructional blocks, and that's where we had our lectures.
So it really was like being at a university in a way.
Yeah, it was. It was the Naval Engineering University. Yeah. At the end of it, we got a degree. You sat your exams. I was then a graduate of the Royal Aeronautical Society because I read aircraft engineering, and so you were then, you know, a graduate to go out into the world if you wanted to, you know, be equal to those in civilian life, because, you know, after all, you did go to aircraft factories, you did, you know, organise and the equipment of aeroplanes and all the rest of it, so you did need to be educated to the same standard as the people who were running the factory. So I suppose that was the idea, yeah.
So you did a year on shore in Kiev, and then you went away for a year at sea?
Where, yeah. Then
where did you go then?
I went to see, what did I do? I went to see, to HMS Birmingham, and the Korean War was on, and she went out to Korea. And
what was HMS Birmingham?
She was a cruiser, so she would have been, you know, a city class cruiser, with big, I can't remember how big the guns were, 9-inch. Anyway, she was a typical cruiser, you know, with two big turrets at the front and two big turrets at the stern, torpedo tube, all those sort of things. You know, she was very much a product of the Second World War. And we went up and down the eastern coast of Korea, shelling it. To what effect, I don't know. The army was ashore, and they would radio us, and we were their sort of battery. So we'd go very slowly, and we'd shoot into the hinterland. We knew we'd made the right decision in joining the Navy, because every now and again we'd send in one of our motorboats and bring off the army, or some of the army. I remember we had a Highland regiment we brought on shore, and we had the gangways down, and there were these filthy chaps, you know, they'd been living in holes in the ground for goodness sakes how long. They were all muddy and, you know, streaked, and they came up the gangway, and they were looking around in amazement. You know, there we all were in our nice clean uniforms with our nice spanking ship, and the contrast to their living conditions and ours must be amazing. You know, we all gave them baths, you know, the ratings took them up to the front, and we took ours down to the wardroom, and we, you know, they had showers, and their stuff was laundered, and then they had a big dinner in the mess and all the rest of it, and then unfortunately they had to go back to their holes in the ground. But we knew we'd done the right thing. Right until the last moment we had clean linen. Yeah.
What were you doing on the ship?
We were sub-lieutenants, and so we had a department. My department was the steering gear. I also had the senior engineer he also had the steering gear, but I mean, he let me get on with it. And so I looked after the steering gear and when it had to be overhauled and that sort of thing. And then we probably moved around twice, or maybe three times, to another department, and we'd be given charge of that. And we also had a division. You know, the divisions on the ship were, you know, engineering, electrical, seamen, so on and so on. And then the division was broken down into smaller groups. And so, you know, I had we'd have been given perhaps 25 men to look after. And so this was our first time of really being responsible people. So we'd have to do their paperwork, deal with, you know, any compassionate requests they had. All that sort of, it was called divisional work. You know, you had to look after your men and cope with whatever problems they had.
And what was it like being in a ship that was firing guns in anger for the first time, I imagine, of your career?
Yes, well, noisy, very noisy. But yes, it was very much the same, really. I mean, you did that for about a week, and then the ship went somewhere to refuel, and went to South Korea. That's right. Yes, I remember we went to Seoul, and for shore leave and things. Yes, I mean, ships, you know, they're usually doing exercises anyway, even if they're not, you know, firing things in anger. So you actually, you know, the guns are being shot every now and again anyway. You know, it's very much the same. The only thing is that you're actually doing it towards a target.
What was there any sentiment in the ship about the war itself? Did you talk?
No, I don't remember that ever coming up. Korea seemed to be... It was then all part of the Cold War, wasn't it? It was really... I suppose we imagined that it was checking the spread of communism. I don't think we ever thought about it. Well, I certainly didn't think about things then. I was gradually getting more politically aware, but I don't think I thought... I thought shooting naval shells into a country wasn't quite a good idea, because you couldn't see what you were doing. You know, the army would say, you know, up two, down three, or whatever, you know, left, right. So you couldn't see, you had no idea actually what you were shooting at. You know, the army was responsible for that. They were giving the directions. We were just the guns.
And what about going ashore for shore leave in Seoul? That must have been quite an interesting experience.
Yes, I can remember going up to, we went up to the sort of front, or some part, maybe it was the demilitarized line anyway, so we could see North Korean soldiers and things. And there were, it was a very military country. The whole place was, you know, massive troops and gun emplacements and all the rest of it in the south. It was just like a big armed camp, as far as I remember. None of those places, you know, the Japanese war was only 10 years ago. You know, the places had been, they were all very tumble down. It wasn't a good run ashore, as they say. No, that didn't happen until we went to Australia or somewhere like that.
So is that where you went on after this?
No, I think we went on to Japan. Yes, I remember we went to Kure and places like that. Yeah.
And how was that? I'm just thinking of this, your background, where you came from, and suddenly, you know,
yeah,
a few years later you're an officer in the Navy, you're travelling to these exotic places which you might...
Yes, I suppose it was very exciting. It was exciting, yes, you were travelling. Thinking about it after, though, you only saw ports. You very seldom got out of the port. And when you did, that was really nice. You know, if you got the British communities all around the world, whenever a ship came in those days, they would invite you home. And so you got, and in some cases in America, it was quite incredible. They'd drive cars down to the dock and give the keys to the quartermaster, that's the man on the gangway. And so when you wanted to go ashore, you went on and got some keys and, yeah, very generous. Drove off in their cars. You usually drove off and saw them, of course, because they were kind enough to lend you their car. At least you could do a visit and say thank you very much. Yes. But in Japan, that was again strange, because I think that Birmingham had taken part in some action. I think she'd maybe taken part in the sinking of that last big aircraft carrier they launched, because we went to Kure, big shipyards, and the management of the shipyards invited all the officers on the ship to ashore for a geisha party, and hot, you know, it was just wonderful. You know, you had the tea party with the geishas, and then you were taken to the baths, and then these other ladies washed you. Yes, and, you know, gave you hot massages and all. It was just beautiful. It was a delightful experience. You know, that Japanese culture is what every boy needs.
Was there any antipathy to the Brits? Or
No, it was the other way around. They were very... this is really strange. We were... our antipathy was to the Japanese. They were, in fact, very hospitable to us and couldn't be more welcoming, which is really strange. Yes, that's right. They should have treated us badly, I think.
You didn't go to Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
No, we didn't do that. No, the Admiralty probably wouldn't send a ship anywhere near there.
So this year abroad, you went to Korea, you went to Japan, you went to Australia. This is the year at sea.
Yes.
And did you have any other ports of call on that?
Well, trip? All the way out, you know, I think we went to Ceylon, of course, and Aden and the, you know, through the Suez Canal and all that sort of thing.
And
yeah.
This is the Suez Canal pre-Suez.
Yes, this is when we were running it. Yeah.
And what was it like going through the Suez Canal on a big cruiser? Then, in this would be what, 53?
Yes, I think it would be 53. Yeah, here we go. Yeah, 1954 that would have been. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And no, it was fine. The canal is a very interesting trip. You know, again, the ship has to be all closed up with the special people steering it. But
Richard Tsonga, Reel 4.
But it's very interesting from the point of view, you know, watching the land go by on either side, and you can see chaps on camels and, you know, groups of people working in the fields, that sort of thing. It is an interesting trip going through the canal.
But it was very obviously then still a part of the British run operation.
Yes, all the way through. Yeah, that's right. And British pilots, you know, on the bridge and that sort of thing. The tugs had, you know, British officers, but I mean everything. All the work was done by Egyptians. You know, the chaps in the white uniforms who were British.
And are there any other points of call that stick in your mind?
No, I'd have to go back through, you know, through my old cuttings book to sort of work out the chronological order. But I remember Ceylon was a beautiful place to go to, and so was Japan. We went to some of those shrines, those sea shrines that the Japanese have, you know, built out of huge blocks of wood with the crossbars, and that you often get those very still